Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Now we are into the final panel, and we're looking at the issue of quality. I thought this little quote from Jeff Krosik, in a way not terribly original, but nevertheless, very pertinent. We're educating students for jobs that haven't yet been invented. Seems to me a very nice summing up of the fact that a lot of the issues we've been talking about today, that the education institutions are dealing with a world where skill sets and aspirations and business practices as well as technology are evolving so fast that it is very difficult for teaching institutions to make sure that they are at the front end of what they need to be at the front end of. So we have got a very interesting and diverse panel from across different areas of education. And as with the last panel, I'm going to ask each of them just to say in a couple of minutes something about themselves and what their preoccupations and obsessions are. Then we'll have a bit of a discussion here and then be open for your questions. So, Andy, can I come to you first? And I'm going to read your title out because it's got so many words in it, I always get them wrong. Professor of Culture, Media and Economy at the Department of Culture, Media and Creative Industries at King's College, London. Thank you. Professor Pratt.
Quite a mouthful. we're engaged in education and research, and one of the things that we do, we have a master's program on cultural and creative industries. So, in a sense, you know, we've got that problem of actually how do you do this sort of stuff and what you do. And I guess this caused us to think quite a lot about these sorts of things, about what it means and what sort of skills people might need and want. And it's precisely the point that everything is changing so quickly. So clearly there are specific areas that people need knowledge about. But it's the key thing that we see over and over again is the need to bring together business and practice, I think. And so it's not just practice, but it's business and ways of doing and ways of interacting. And I think it's that's a sort of central point to what we do. And what I value about what we do is we have an incredibly diverse range of students from all over the world. And you know, that's the sort of environment that people like to really engage with because, as all the points we've said on the previous panel, they come to be challenged and they want to put themselves in a position to be challenged and learn the sorts of ways of coping with that. I mean, the way of operating is to operate in any different environment to deal with the things, as Jeff Krosik said, that haven't happened yet. So if we can build those sorts of skills. So it's about bringing together both practice and business in some way. It's also about this issue of the bringing together the formal and the informal. I think, you know, a lot of what we do when we talk about sort of training and skills and all that sort of thing tends to be the sort of more of the formal stuff. But as we also know, a hugely important part of any participation in the cultural and creative sector is about engaging with informal activity, whether they're about one's own informal sort of cultural activities or with people doing things informally. And actually, it's at that interface where most of the really exciting stuff happens. And so you've got to know how to balance that and also balance people in other areas of expertise. So it's like, we need insight into how stuff happens, and I think that this is crucial. And because the how stuff happens, how we do stuff, how we do engaging in creativity and how we think about that, it's not generally what used to happen in the car industry or in the steel industry. And we don't know so much about creativity stuff, but it doesn't just happen. It's something you can learn about, and things are happening and changing very quickly. How we organize stuff, how we do architecture design, how we do new media, how we do television is changing so quickly. Yeah? We need to appreciate that because it is different, yeah? And we need sets of skills. And one of the things, I think, that you know, comes over again and again with students and as a challenge for us as educators is the challenge, really, of people needing what I call reflexive career management skills. In other words, how do they cope, yeah, in this situation where everything is changing and they're forced back on this situation where they have to manage their job and their career? That's a bit much to throw on someone's shoulders when they hardly know what they're doing, in a way. And so there are a lot of things that you can talk about there. But you know, some of the things that are really important that are so difficult to sort of talk about is the way that you have to manage yourself and manage your reputation, and a way that you don't force it down someone's throat, but you're actually able to bury the ego to an extent so you can find out about what other people are doing. And another part of that is about this job of how you get people to work with you. Yeah? And it's about understanding other people's motivation. Yeah? And so I think actually the model for managing in this sphere is more like a film director, in a way. Yeah? It's about that job of bringing people together, massaging egos, having big visions, in a way, and bringing people along with you. Yeah, and coping with all the frictions between them. And that's not the normal sort of management type of job, which is normally to trample people down and say, yeah, you do it this way in some way. Part of the skill is actually working with this wide range of talent that you get. Another element to this is the fact that you will fail a lot. Yeah, and again, that's not part of the normal scenario for many jobs where you're meant to be successful all the time. Part of working at the edge and doing really creative stuff is you have to fail, and you have to push failure a lot, and you have to think of things in a broader portfolio of stuff that you do, and you need to be able to communicate that to other people, that actually failure is important to success, and you need to learn from it, but that everything you do is not automatically going to be successful, and that's actually really good. Yeah, that's the way you get the edgy stuff. Otherwise, you just go to the boring easy bits in the middle. And I think that the third area that is really important in terms of engaging with all of this is about actually using other people. Using other people, finding support networks in some way. And I think particularly in the cultural sector where people are increasingly isolated on their own career trajectories and their own sort of training strategies, etc., is that we all need intermediaries. We need networks to plug into. Also, that we don't always have this complete range of skill sets. And therefore, you know, if I'm involved in a small business, then actually maybe I don't want to be an accountant, and I'm no good at being an accountant. So wouldn't it be good if we could get somebody who knew how to speak to me, could be an accountant, and then I could get on with doing what I'm good at? Yeah, and that would seem sensible. It's not saying that you don't need accountancy. We all know that you do. But actually get something appropriate. And there are all sorts of what people often call real services. It's the real skills that are around there that oftentimes people don't want to do, or that they're so focused on the thing that they're doing, drop by the wayside. And sometimes these can act as really negative things that will stop us doing the things that you want to do. But these sorts of jobs, you know, if you like, creative accountants are good, yeah. But also, there are other intermediaries as well that allow us to speak to one another and speak across one another, and that sometimes are there to do some of the strategic guidance about where we're going, that people will hold the conversations that we don't always want to do. These people need training, yeah? We need to create these sorts of skills, and the people that understand the problems of both those that are in practice and those that are in business and those that are tasked with trying to govern them in some way. Yeah? And it's not an easy thing because each side mistrusts the other mightily. Yeah? And therefore, building trust in this relationship is based upon reputation, on being able to do it in some way, yeah? So they're the sorts of things that I think that we're constantly struggle with, but they give the possibility of being able to cope with unknown situations. You work about ways that you can fix stuff and move on to the next thing and provide some ecosystem you can work in. And they're the sorts of, this all sounds like rather fuzzy things, but actually I think they're the things that plug together all these skill sets and allow people to work and operate in the field. So.
Thank you. Heath Reed, I'm going to ask to speak next. Heath is from Sheffield Hallam University, and you all have such complicated titles. I'm going to read this one out as well to make sure I get it correct. Principal Industrial Designer at Design Futures, the Art and Design Research Centre at Sheffield Hallam University. Heath.
Yeah, thank you. Convoluted job title, but basically I'm an industrial designer. Have been for about 15 years. Came to it quite late, and before that was involved in a whole really wide range of other activity. Firstly, can I just say thanks for the invitation. Unlike many people here, I'm from practice, not teaching or policy, so it's really good to be invited. And I just wanted to focus this 5 minutes on interdisciplinary practice and innovation as factors when we're talking about what should we teach. Before I do that, I just wanted to briefly describe exactly what it is we do that might be associated with that convoluted job title. Art design activity at Hallam is divided into three really broad areas of teaching, research, and practice. All, in my case, a lot of it's consultancy. And I'm sure that's similar for many institutions. But in recent years, what's been happening is there's been a blurring of the distinctions between those things. Teaching and research have often gone together a lot anyway, but probably less so practice and consultancy. So there's been these overlapping between those core areas. But not only within art and design, as a university with many other disciplinary-specific areas, you know, very many from biosciences through materials engineering, we've actually been overlapping with those teams as well. So that, you know, that has meant for us working more closely with those diverse disciplines, as I say, from everything from robotics to biosciences to health. And it really is quite broad. And it's those sort of, those sort of shaded areas of co-development and co-delivery that me and my colleagues spend most of our time. And I think that bringing in design approaches into those disciplines has really led to those sort of high levels of innovation and creativity in subject areas, importantly, that we might not normally associate with the creative industries. A few comments today, I'm reminded that at a conference recently, we had a molecular biologist, I'm sure he was, who was presenting, and he actually got quite resentful about the title creative industries, because he says to do his job, he has to be highly creative. So, I mean, I think there's a bit of ownership and protection about that issue. So, I mean, that really brings me to my first link, the one with Engineering for Life written underneath it. It's actually the homepage of Engineering for Life. That was actually funded by the EPSRC, and it's been running for the last 3 years. It's just coming to an end. And it's under an initiative called Bridging the Gap, and Hallam was one of a number of universities, including Strathclyde, UWE, and others, who have been running a number of inter- and multidisciplinary projects for quite a while. And a lot of those projects were actually featured in the conference, Understanding Interdisciplinary Theory and Practice, and an exhibition called Encompass, which went alongside it. And that finished just 2 weeks ago. So for me, this is really relevant and topical. Interdisciplinarity, even though I can't get my mouth around it all the time, is a word which actually hasn't come up much today, which I've been surprised. There's been lots of other descriptions of other words for it. But I think a high proportion of those projects were not only supported, but design actually helped to direct the journey that a lot of those projects went on. So the second link there is the link to the University of North Texas. They have a Center for the Study of Interdisciplinarity, and it's under the directorship of Professor Robert Frodeman. And Frodeman actually gave a keynote at that conference I just mentioned, and I just wanted to pick up on one thing he said. In the Q&A session, he was asked how he advises his students about managing sort of diversity and complexity around some of these issues. And his reply was, "I tell them, take two majors." And, you know, that does say an awful lot about the changing nature, about how we deal with some of these things. And then the last example, I'm sure this is really widely known. I keep forgetting about it, and I keep watching it to remind myself, but it's John Cleese on creativity. And I guess it was around the early 90s, so from two current examples to quite an old one. And he covers a wide range of topics, so things that have come up today, but these open and closed ways of thinking, and that often having other people to actually play with when we're, and I say play, if you watch a film, if you know it, you'll know why. Actually, it's that leads to these original outcomes. And he defines it as thinking creatively can be facilitated by seeing links between things that may not have been made before, or as he says, new juxtapositions. And yet, to quote, he says, to connect two hitherto separate ideas in a way that generates new meaning. And in my language, that describes innovation and working and playing in interdisciplinary ways. But the last 5 minutes of that film, I think, are really crucial, because it actually, with a lot of humour, describes actually how some of our institutions can get things wrong sometimes. So in closing, and back to the question, it just says, you know, we're educating young people for jobs that haven't been invented, and what should we teach them? Well, I don't think there's actually any question that we should be developing interdisciplinary thinking in teaching. But I do suggest that our current institutional conditions can create pressures and tensions that actually are contrary to that, because our institutions have evolved in traditional ways and they are necessarily siloed by discipline. And we have lots of examples to draw on when we're thinking about interdisciplinary. And I'm not suggesting that we should chuck away the disciplines and, you know, just go for interdisciplinarity, but I think there are elements within teaching that we need to get back to, which involve looking at things from different perspectives.
So that's my Heath, thank you. That's okay. Interdisciplinarity is not a word that happened upon until now. Danny Salvadori has got what I think by any measure is a cool job title, which is Director of Enterprise and Innovation. Isn't that right?
Yep, that's right.
At Central St Martin's. Not only a cool job title, but a pretty cool new building at King's Cross as well. Danny.
Right, so my job title is Director of Enterprise and Innovation, and my job is extremely pragmatic. It's a bringing in money job. I don't teach, and I'm not really involved in research. So I'm seeing things very much from the perspective of trying to relate between the day-to-day life of the college, which is largely about teaching, and businesses out there. And my department's role is to provide a link between those businesses and the students and the courses in the college. And we've packaged up some ways of doing that, so mostly through student-sponsored projects, where a company will come in and work with a group of students, often fitting into the curriculum. And increasingly, we're developing strategic relationships with companies who want a longer-term relationship with us. And this part of our work brings in, this year will have brought in about £750,000. So it's actually quite a substantial source of income for the college. About a quarter of our students are involved in it at any one time. And we've got 35 to 40 of these relationships every year. So we're seeing a lot of demand from... They're often very large companies. We tend not to work with SMEs because they can't afford us. So we're seeing a lot of demand. And I think, reflecting on what I've just heard since I've been here and what I'm about to say, that what we are good at and what we struggle with is a microcosm of what is actually happening in the design industry. So what we can deliver really well within our institutional framework, which, remember, is almost entirely practice-based. We have 4,500 students, and all but about 150 of them are practice-based. So we're able to produce articulate students who are able to talk about their work and respond to briefs in their discipline, and they can do fantastic work, particularly when we put them with a tutor who has a significant commercial practice outside the institution. And they can raise the expectations of the students themselves and graduates, because we do this with graduates too, about what they can deliver with the client. And there's a really good example of that at the moment on the big screens that are by the Euston Underpass. There's some on the West Way and one in Holborn as well. And there's a campaign on there for Nikon. And actually it's a graduate consultancy project that my team organised. And the tutor drove us nuts absolutely nuts because he wouldn't be satisfied with what the students were, the graduates were producing. But in the end, we got a wonderful result because his expectations were really high. So I think we can do that really well. We can give new businesses new thinking in product development, in brand identity, in graphic communication, some of our core disciplines. We can really deliver on that. And we can package up our own brand so that companies feel they're getting a bit of it. And one of our clients describes that as our fairy dust. So we're good at all of that. But there are some things that we really, really struggle with. And actually, they are the things that Andy has described as being required in the broker role. So clients come to us and they think that just because our students are young, they know how to deliver in social media. Well, they don't. They know how to use Facebook. They might tweet a bit. They might use Instagram a bit. They've never thought strategically about how any of that works, and nor have their tutors. So I think it's a big gap that we find ourselves having to find ways of plugging. Within my team, we've identified the experience economy as a real driver for where things are going, which is why I put a shopping mall on my list of references. And I have to say, a big report that Andy was involved with. So that's a good circular reference.
And Kate was here earlier,
yeah. What we're just about to experience in a month's time in the Olympics, that's the experience economy. Working in King's Cross, that's it in a nutshell. It's a big driver of new developments in the economy. But it cuts across disciplines, and we're really having problems finding traction for the idea, even though we've got clients who want to work with us. We're finding real problem in having traction with the academics, because they can see their graduates going into these new ways of working, but they don't know how to fit their disciplines into it. And I think that that's going to be an increasing problem. I think some disciplines are really hamstrung by their own vocabularies, and I think particularly fine artists are really hamstrung by their own vocabularies. They've developed their own little world, and they, like scientists perhaps, they're very happy speaking in their own vocabularies. If the moment you take them out of that vocabulary and ask them to speak in a different way to somebody who values their work, wants to value their work, wants to work with them, they find that transition really, really hard, and I think their tutors do too. And despite what Andy says, it's really hard to work across institutions. And that's a big issue, because when you're a monotechnic like we are, we don't have science and we don't have business. And, you know, some of that is about just the logistics of doing it. I've lost count of the number of times I've had conversations with colleagues in engineering courses in other universities who want to work with us, and their curriculum is rigid and ours is fluid, and we can never make it work. But occasionally we've managed it, and we've just finished a really excellent project sponsored by Heinz with the Judge Business School, their MBA students, our MA communication design students. The project almost fell apart on the very first session when they put a tutor in to lecture all the students involved about what was cool. Our students felt so patronized that six of them walked off the project there and then. I know they're sensitive souls, but nonetheless, there's a real there can be real cultural problems. And that project took an enormous amount of academic and business development staff time to make it work. So really, I think that the issues for HEIs are about embedding new thinking fast enough and moving out of discipline silos. I think they're really, really tricky, particularly when you're practice-based, and it's there's a lot of skill to learn as well as thinking.
Danny, thank you. Garrick, I noticed quite a lot of nod-along there from you as Danny was talking.
So difficult coming at the end.
Garrick Jones is a walking example of interdisciplinarity. Research fellow at the LSE, senior tutor in innovation and industrial design at the Royal College of Art, and also a partner in Ludic Group, which I presume is, well, I know it's your
design
business.
It's the one that
makes money. I was trying to find a polite way of saying that. Yeah. Garrick.
Thank you. It's such a great topic, this. I found myself about 6 years, maybe 7 years ago, in a strange position. I'd set up the new business, the Ludic Group, and we had some far-reaching ideas and a great team. But at the same time, I was invited by the LSE to come and be a research fellow there, which I took up because I was very interested in the group I wanted to work there with. And then I found myself asked if I would come to the Royal College in Industrial Design and Engineering, as it was at the time, and get involved there because I'd done a lot of collaborative work, interdisciplinary work, and designed some sort of new spaces, new types of environments, which Royal College had got involved in. And the weird thing at the same time was I was asked this question, it's almost simultaneously in both institutions, and that was, can you help us make a new course, and can it be innovative in some way? And the weird thing about the London School of Economics is that everything is traditionally very theoretically based, it's very rigorous and very thorough, and it's taught in 3-hour segments during the day in traditional lectures for the most part, certainly was at the time. And the Royal College is a practice-based institution, everything's studio-based, and it basically runs on the idea that if you put a lot of very talented people in one place and mix it up, you're going to get some results somehow. Anyway, cut a long story short, I found these two ideas sort of interacting, and they asked me to put together an open innovation course or a course around innovation at the London School of Economics. And, well, I wanted to do that in an innovative way. I didn't feel you could teach innovation in a non-innovative way. And then the same thing at the Royal College. They wondered, how do we expand? Because the question was, how do we expand what we're doing? The first thing we did was we started a campaign to change the name from Industrial Design and Engineering to now Innovation Design and Engineering, which took about 5 years because of the legacy of the Royal College. But we got there. And the second thing was, in both cases, the tendency was to go into practice-based business, perhaps link people to society, link people to business, and allow students to not only learn some stuff from great people who are involved in the world, but also to reflect that in their own projects and so on. So at the LSE, we now have an open innovation course which has about 10 weeks of theory and tuition and tutorship and so on, but also then has 11 weeks of practical application where we have about 10 or 12 partners ranging from the Cabinet Office to Demos to IBM and Unilever and so on. So you've got this huge range, and then they take the theory and they apply it, and they judge on both. Huge problems in marking that because the LSE insists on an individual mark for everybody. So how do you get the group work and group mark in there? Well, we've had to crack that. And also, how do you mark things in a fair way, and how do you ensure that people don't feel in groups that people aren't pulling their weight and so on. So, yeah, we kind of got there 6 years, quite popular. On the Royal College side, the tendency has been to open it up to research instead of just allowing a small kind of closed circle of engineering and design to kind of be thinking about things. We started to bring in research, qualitative research, and so on. 6 years ago, it wasn't such a big deal. As it is now, it's almost commonplace. That had a huge impact on the kinds of work we were doing. And then, of course, we also have connections with industry, and we do a lot of projects and modules where there's specific students working for groups. So it's opened up. One final story was, I think the toughest thing I did about 4 years ago was to try and do a project between the LSE and the Royal College. Just stupid idea. But because the timetables didn't coordinate, and people have different pressures on their time in different ways. It meant a lot of late-night seminars and lectures, and it meant a lot of asking students from one institution to really come and meet students from the other and put time in. We had to take people to the bar a lot and, you know, make it worthwhile. But we did get 3 projects out of 10 of those projects which went on to win awards, both nationally and one internationally. So it was really worthwhile. You know, for example, there is social science research at the LSE about autistic children requiring feeling safe if they are held in some way, and design students taking that information and turning it into hoodies and clothing that children can pull strings and gives them comfort and can make them feel safe. So there's a direct relationship between good research, proper research, and then people being exposed to it and building on it, standing on the shoulders of giants. So I don't think I'm adding anything to what's been said, but interdisciplinarity is important. The collaboration is important. Going the extra mile and working hard to make it happen is important. Enthusiasm is important, and being open. The final thing, the other thing that's come up so much is language. How do you cross the language barrier? And I think that's why this is one of my favorite books, Gödel, Escher, Bach, by Douglas Hofstadter. I don't have 3 because I thought if I'm putting up Gödel, Escher, and Bach, that's probably just more than enough. But the wonderful thing about this book, Gödel being the mathematician who did nested loops, understanding, and Escher being Marcel, the illustrator who does
like
metamorphosis of the hands and all that, and Bach, of course, being the incredible genius of music and structural music, Baroque. And this book is written in a way that shows how the music and the maths and the visualization all kind of links together. And there is a language that he reinvents the language from these 3 disciplines to tell the story. And he uses Lewis Carroll and various other kind of poetry, kind of makes some really powerful points about artificial intelligence and so on. And I think the final thing is about what do we teach our children, or what do we teach the next generation? Well, by teaching LSE students about design, a little bit of design. Not architecture is great, but design allows you to get there quite quickly. And I loved your expression of the 4 different types of design, from style all the way through to problem solving and frameworking. That's a really helpful skill. And the other skill, or the other language skill, which I think is really powerful, and I'll end with this, is production. How do you put a producer, or somebody who has access to a number of resources and people, who brings them all together and allows them to sequence and structure things over time so that you can make things happen? That kind of facilitation, brokerage, production skills is really, really useful. Ask a bunch of LSE students to make a film and put some filmmakers with them and send them out. And they learn a whole bunch of skills, not only about teamwork and collaboration, but communication and sequencing production and so on. Those are skills that transcend. And that's it, really.
Garrick, thank you very much. I think those are 4 great stories from the front line, if I can put it like that. Now, we really are pushed for time. And so what I'm going to suggest is that if any of the 4 panelists have got comments they want to make on what each other has said, fine, you have a couple of minutes to do that. Then we're going to have some questions, and then we'll draw this to a close because we are perilously tight on time. Garrick, you've already referred to 1 or 2 of the other things that the other panelists said. Andy or Heath, do you have any comments on what Danny and Garrick and Heath have been talking about?
I just sort of follow up on the interdisciplinary issue. I think this is, it's interdisciplinary in academic disciplines, but it's also interdisciplinary in terms of forms as well that people are engaged in. And the really interesting stuff happens where people are testing those boundaries between those, or pushing them, or stretching them in some ways. My unit's actually in Arts and Humanities School, although my training is a social scientist. I used to be at LSE as well. But I also did geography and urban studies, which is always about sort of going beyond disciplinary boundaries. So I've always looked at those to see the value of those boundaries. And I think that it comes back to me time and again that actually the interesting things are the way that you try to put 2 things together that probably haven't had a conversation. And I think actually the metaphor of innovation, and this will go for creativity as well, that we ought to be working with is one about translation. and it's about gained in translation. It's about the way that we actually learn through solving problems and solving problems through different conceptual mindsets, and that's the sort of thing. There's no direct... The worst sort of translation is mechanical translation, where you get a word for word, and that's really boring and it doesn't capture the stuff. The gained in translation is the creative stuff we do. And you could think about that both in terms of language, but it's also in terms of ideas, where you get two or three people together, you really gain something if people are prepared to sit back and listen and find out where the solutions are. And I think, you know, if only we could use that instead of knowledge transfer, which is like death.
I think gained in translation is a lovely phrase. Heath.
I think there's a sort of coalescing of things that, picking up what everyone said, not just now, but today, it's, for me, interdisciplinarity, which is a key and topical issue, is, you know, when that happens, we can see really multifaceted things come out of it. And I think that's important in terms of outputs as well. I mean, so much of our activity is measured on outputs, and when we do engage in interdisciplinarity, we can see academic outputs, we can see industrial outputs, and I think that kind of activity just ticks more of the boxes that need to be ticked until we get into a position where institutions learn to be less siloed and less disciplinary specific.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think it's intriguing to look at what happens to graduates in the first 5 years after they leave, because they come out of quite siloed institutions like the Royal College, like Sir Joseph Martin's, other UAL colleges, but they don't stay siloed. So what are we giving them that enables them to do that moving, even though the institutions don't seem to be able to do it? And I think that's intriguing. There's a challenge for you, Andy.
Well, it makes me think about failure again. I was asked, I don't even know, INSEAD, the French business school, was looking at their students, where they've been for 5 years, same story. And they decided to get a number of them back to have a conference, sort of tell us about your life. And they couldn't get enough people to come until they restyled the conference about failure and said, come and tell us the most interesting stories that you've had. And then they had pretty much a packed house. And it was like we had a fantastic facilitator, also out of theatre, who knows about allowing people the space or creating spaces for people to feel safe and do things. And basically it was 20 senior people who'd been 5 years thinking they were gods when they'd left school, and been in the real world just talking about failures, and of course they had a great time. But it's this thing about innovation, interdisciplinarity, language, translating, but continually talking, because you fail until you succeed, I think is the or that wonderful Samuel Beckett quote, try again, fail better.
Thank you. Okay, we will have one round of questions. I'm conscious of the fact that one or two people have to get trains and don't want to miss the last pearls of wisdom. If there are some questions, let's have them now. Be brief in your questions, be brief in your answers, and then we're going to draw this to a close. Any comments or questions that people would like to make? In which case, it only remains for me to do one thing which I should have done at the beginning and which I omitted to do, and that is to remind you all that we have a range of sponsors for today. And for the benefit of some of you on the panel, you may not be aware of the fact that this is being streamed live and there's film content as well. So there are a lot of people participating in this who aren't actually here in this room. And as well as thanking Neil Stewart Associates, who've put this this day together, the supporters are the Design Business Association, Creative Skill Set, Creative and Cultural Skills, and UKadia. So thanks to all of them for sponsoring the day. And thanks to all of you for sticking with it. I think it's been a really interesting day. The frustrating thing, as ever, with a good conversation like this is that actually we could have spun it out over at least 3 days. I'd particularly like to thank this panel. All four of you have told really interesting stories, and it does seem to me very appropriate to finish with kind of stories of real practice out there in the world. So thank you all very much, and let's all give a round of applause to the panel.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.